These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Classical Mythology, Part 2. The lecturer is Professor Elizabeth Vandiver. Dr. Vandiver teaches classics at the University of Maryland at College Park. After receiving her MA and PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, she held visiting professorships at Northwestern University, the University of Georgia, the Intercollegiate Center for Classical Studies in Rome, Loyola University of New Orleans, and Utah State. Professor Vandiver has published Heroes in Herodotus, The Interaction of Myth and History, and is currently working on a second book examining the influence of the classical tradition on the British poets of the First World War. In 1998, Dr. Vandiver received the American Philological Association's Excellence in Teaching Award, the most prestigious teaching award available to American classical scholars. Her other awards include the Northwestern University Department of Classics Excellence in Teaching Award for 1998 and the University of Georgia's Outstanding Honors Professor Award in 1993 and 1994. Each of Dr. Vandiver's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 13, Humans, Heroes, and Half-Gods.
Hello, and welcome back to Lecture 13. In the previous lecture, we concluded our examination of the gods of Greek mythology by discussing the possible cultural and prehistorical background for the myths that we'd looked at. In the second half of the course, we're going to move on to concentrating on the heroes of Greek myth, and we're going to begin our examination of the heroes by setting them in context through looking at the story of how humans were created, as Hesiod tells it in Works and Days. Now, as you'll remember, we saw that Hesiod's Theogony, his main account of the creation of the universe in general and the gods in particular, does not contain a creation story for men, though it does mention the creation of the first woman. However, in Works and Days, Hesiod's other great poem, he does include an account of how humans in general came into being. This story that he tells in Works and Days is often referred to as the Myth of the Five Ages or Myth of the Five Races, because in it, Hesiod describes five successive races of human beings, starting with the Golden Race or Golden Age and ending with his own time, his own group of humans, whom he describes as being a race of iron. The overall pattern in Hesiod's account of the five different races of human beings is one of degeneration and increased hardship. He begins by describing the first race of humans, the Golden Race. He says this race was created by the immortals who dwell on Mount Olympus, and that the Golden Race was created during the reign of Cronos. So far back in time, before Zeus overthrew his father Cronos, before the universe was set into the form that it would hold thereafter, according to the Myth of the Five Ages, there was a golden race of humans. Their existence was characterized first and foremost by the lack of any kind of care or trouble. They had no difficulties, and specifically, old age did not exist. According to Hesiod, people in the Golden Age did not have to work for food. The earth simply produced food for them. So there was no necessity for work, for toil, no cares, no hardship, and no old age. They did, however, die out. And Hesiod says they became benevolent spirits who still are around watching out for later human beings. So even in the Golden Age, Hesiod does not suggest that there was ever a time when humans did not have to die. As we talked about before, mortality is there for human beings as a defining characteristic of human beings from the very beginning. After the Golden Race came the Silver Race, and there you see the beginning of the pattern of degeneration. Silver is less than gold, so the second race of humans is less than the first race. They too, Hesiod says, were created by the Olympians, and they are a rather odd race in that their main characteristic is that they lived for 100 years as children, nourished by their mothers, Hesiod says. So they had a 100-year-long childhood. Then when these people reached maturity, they lived a short while because they were violent and irreverent. In particular, they refused to pay proper sacrifices to the gods, and so Zeus wiped them out. Zeus destroyed the silver race of human beings. Then, Hesiod says, Zeus himself created the third race of humans, the bronze race. They, according to Hesiod, were made by Zeus from ash trees. That seems like an odd source for a race of human beings, but probably the implication there has to do with the fact that the word that means ash tree in Greek is also used by Homer in particular to mean a spear, because the handle of a spear was made from the wood of the ash tree, and so the word itself came to mean spear. Probably what Hesiod is implying here is that the bronze race was extremely violent and warlike, and that they owed their origin to the same material from which spears are made. He said that they used bronze for everything, including their homes, and that they were extraordinarily warlike. They too died out. Hesiod seems to imply that they killed each other off. Now, following the pattern of degeneration as symbolized by metals of lesser value, you would expect the next race after bronze to be the iron race. But in fact, Hesiod inserts here the race of heroes, to whom he does not assign a metal, and who he says were actually better than, superior to, the preceding bronze race. So there's a little bit of a break in the pattern, which allows Hesiod to account for the race of heroes, who are so important in the myths that he and his culture know. The race of heroes, Hesiod says, was also created by Zeus, as the bronze race before them had been. Hesiod calls them demigods. By that, he's probably referring to the idea that many heroes had one parent, usually the father, sometimes the mother, who was a god. He calls them demigods, and he says that they were the men who fought around Thebes and Troy, i.e., these heroes, this fourth race of human beings, whom Hesiod calls the heroes, are the people who figure in the stories of Greek myth, the stories of the Theban cycle, such as Oedipus the king and his family, and the stories of the Trojan War. But they too died, according to Hesiod. Most of them died and went to the underworld where humans normally go. Some, he says, Zeus settled in the islands of the blessed, referring to that idea we discussed before, that a very few, very extraordinary humans get some kind of happy afterlife. But most of the race of heroes simply died off. This brings us to the fifth and worse race, the race of Hesiod's own day, which he calls the race of iron. For the fifth race, no creator is mentioned, and Hesiod describes the fifth race, the iron race's lot, as one of increasing hardship and unhappiness. He says, describing it, "I wish I were not counted among the fifth race of men, but rather had died before or been born after it. This is the race of iron. Neither day nor night will give them rest, as they waste away with toil and pain. Growing cares will be given them by the gods, and their lot will be a blend of good and bad." He goes on to say that Zeus will eventually destroy this race of mortals as well when children are born already gray-haired. That is a vivid and, I think, very chilling description of the increasingly bad lot of the iron race. One of the main characteristics of the iron race's trouble is old age, disease, and care. children being born gray at the temple seems to imply that there will come a time when human beings are old from the moment of birth, when just as the golden age never suffered old age, there will come a time when the iron race will know nothing but old age. And at that point, Zeus will destroy us as well. The only end in sight for the iron race, as Hesiod describes it, is for things to get worse and worse and worse. He goes through a list of how bad things will get. He says that as the iron race continues to deteriorate, sons will not reverence their fathers, friends will not be trustworthy with one another, brothers will fight brothers, and eventually, he says, shame and retribution, eidos and nemesis in Greek, will veil their faces and flee the earth, and then, in effect, society will break down entirely. Without shame and retribution, there will be no controls on human activity whatsoever. So the iron race, Hesiod's own race, is painted in very, very pessimistic tones indeed. The only slight element of hopefulness in this picture is that Hesiod states he wishes he had been born before or after the iron race, which seems to imply that there will be an after, that there may be another race of humans eventually created. Now, one thing to notice about this myth of the five ages or five races is that it seems to contradict the Pandora story, which Hesiod has recounted just a very few lines before the myth of the five ages in Works and Days. If it doesn't flat out contradict the Pandora story, at the very least, the myth of the five ages does not dovetail neatly with the Pandora story. Because, for instance, there are mothers in the Silver Age. The silver race lives for 100 years as babies or as small children, nourished by their mothers, Hesiod says. Well, where do those mothers come from? If there are no cares or evils yet in the Silver Age, and there aren't, then how can there be mothers when Pandora, just a few lines before, is said to be the source of all females and to bring cares and troubles with her? This, I think, should remind us that Hesiod is not attempting here to come up with the one and only orthodox account of the creation of human beings. Just as we talked about before with theogony, so here too, he's not attempting an orthodoxy. Rather, he's using the traditional myths that he knows to look at the realities of human society from one angle, then from another angle. The fact that the myths sometimes don't fit quite perfectly with one another is only a problem if you're trying to construct an overall coherent, logical narrative, and that's not what he's trying to do here. Rather, he focuses first on the Pandora story and secondly on the myth of the five ages. Another implication here is that the question of where humans came from is not the most pressing issue by any means in Greek mythology. That often surprises modern readers. We tend to think that our origin, how we got here, what we're doing in the world, has got to be the focal point of any religious or mythological system. But for Greek myth, it isn't. Humans, particularly male humans, are more or less just a given, and the myths that we have looked at so far and will continue to look at are far more concerned with how humans should act, given that we're here, and how society should function than with the origins of human beings. Now, I think it's fair to say that Hesiod's account of the five races gives a very pessimistic view of human existence in general and of the iron race in particular. With the exception of the race of heroes, we have an overall deterioration from good to not so good to bad to really bad. And Hesiod doesn't offer any hope for people of his own race that things will ever get better. Once again, I want to compare Hesiod's account with the account given by the Roman author Ovid in his work Metamorphoses some 700 years later. You'll remember Ovid was writing in the 1st century BC and 1st century AD. He was right on that dividing line in Rome. And in Metamorphoses, which he begins by giving his version of the creation of the universe, Ovid also recaps and modifies Hesiod's story of the different ages or races of humans. And I think it's interesting to see the different emphasis that Ovid puts on the story and how he makes it a far more optimistic account than it is in Hesiod's presentation. Ovid recaps the myth of the ages, but there are significant differences in his telling of this myth. Most importantly, there is no intervening race of heroes. Ovid simply takes the underlying pattern, gold, silver, bronze, iron, and leaves the heroes out entirely. He agrees with Hesiod that the iron race was absolutely terrible and that it would eventually be destroyed by Zeus, or Jupiter, to give him his Roman name, since Ovid is a Roman author. But in Ovid's presentation, all of that is in the past. The iron race is in the past as much as any of the other races are. And he tells us that, in fact, Zeus did destroy the iron race. He wiped them out by a great flood. So who then are we? Well, we are descendants, through a very odd process, of the two survivors of that flood. Now, just one quick side note here. Obviously, the flood story is a very clear example of cross-cultural parallels in different mythic traditions, perhaps of cross-cultural influence. There's the flood story as recounted for us by Ovid in classical mythology. There's a flood story in Mesopotamian myth. And of course, the most familiar flood story occurs in Genesis with the story of Noah. So here again, we may have cross-cultural influence between these different mythologies coming up with a very similar story. According to Ovid, the only two people to survive the great flood, the only two members of the iron race who survived, were Deucalion and Pyrrha. Deucalion is the man, Pyrrha is the woman. Their little boat ran aground on Mount Parnassus, which is where Delphi is, and they went to ask the oracle of Delphi. Now, how there can be an oracle speaking in Apollo's temple if everyone, including the Pythia, is dead, Ovid doesn't bother to tell us. They go and ask the oracle what they should do. They're the only two surviving humans in the world. What should they do? The oracle tells them, throw the bones of your mother over your shoulders. They react at first with horror at the idea of desecrating their mother's graves until they realize that what the oracle means is to throw the stones of the earth over their shoulders. The earth is the great mother of all living things. Rocks, stones are to her as bones are to the human body. Therefore, they're not sure it will work, but as Ovid says, how could it hurt to try? They pick up rocks, throw them over their shoulders as they walk. The rocks that Deucalion throws become men. The rocks that Pyrrha throws become women. Now, let's think for a moment about the implications of that. In Ovid's presentation, not only are we not the iron race, we're not even related to the iron race. We are a whole different, separate creation. We grow out of the rocks of the earth that Deucalion and Pyrrha threw over their shoulders. And Ovid says, we show our origin in the fact that we are a hardy race, able to endure a great deal of toil and trouble. We show where we came from by our hardiness. Once again, as I talked about very briefly when we discussed Ovid's creation story, we can see here how Ovid is using the traditional myth of the five races, as Hesiod preserves it, as a literary device rather than as a still functioning, living mythic tradition. He puts in a lot of authorial comment, like, how could it hurt to try throwing the stones over their shoulders? He also writes in a tone that is much less serious than Hesiod's tone. There's a lot of humor in Ovid. And more particularly, I think we see in Ovid a kind of self-conscious pointing out of the ideological nature of the story as he tells it, where Hesiod, or myths that are closer to oral tradition, to the original status of myth, don't say, now look, we come from stones, that's why we're hardy. That may be implicit in a traditional myth, but it's not spelled out. Ovid spells it out for us. Ovid is almost doing a commentary on the myths that he recounts. Also, another aspect of Ovid's telling of the story is, again, that since we are separated from the earlier races, since we have no real connection with the iron race that was destroyed by the flood, it's easy for Ovid to be more optimistic about the future of whatever we would call us. I guess we'd have to call ourselves the Stone Age, misleading though that might be. It's easy to be much more optimistic about our future than Hesiod allows for, because all of the trials and tribulations Hesiod describes, Ovid puts firmly in the past. As I said, Ovid simply omits the race of heroes. What I want to do now is turn to discussing who these heroes are, whom Hesiod places right before our own day and who seem to be so important in Hesiod's account of the different generations of humans, that he has to put them in even though they break the pattern of metals and they break the pattern of degeneration. Who are they? Why are they so important to Hesiod? What's implied by Ovid leaving them out? Well, just as God is a misleading translation of the term theos, as I discussed before, so too hero is a misleading translation of the Greek word heros, or at least the modern understanding of what's implied by the term hero in modern American culture is misleading when we look at the heroes of Greek mythology. The heroes of classical myth are not necessarily noble, good, or morally exemplary. Sometimes they are quite the opposite. Sometimes they are extraordinarily bad people rather than extraordinarily good people. And by the way, this is one reason many scholars find fault with Joseph Campbell's treatment of heroes, particularly his discussion in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Campbell takes it as a given that cross-culturally and throughout time, the hero is motivated by a desire to provide a boon, as Campbell calls it, for his fellow humans, that that's what motivates the hero's adventures, the desire to bring a boon back to humanity. But in the case of many, if not most, Greek hero tales, this is emphatically not the case. Many Greek heroes undergo adventures, yes, and sometimes their actions in those adventures may have beneficent consequences for other humans, but the hero's motivation is not normally to help other humans, and at times, in fact, his actions have bad repercussions for other human beings. What does the word heros in Greek mean if it doesn't mean an exceptionally good, morally exemplary person out to help his fellow human beings? Well, it has three basic meanings in ancient Greek. Hero could refer to a dead person who was revered and to whom sacrifices were offered. This is the meaning of hero when you read about hero sacrifice, hero worship, and so forth. These dead people who were seen as somehow still being spirits to whom sacrifice could and should be offered were very frequently associated with one particular city. Often a hero would be considered protective of a particular city because he had founded it or ruled over it, though that's not always the case. And in this meaning, the term hero really can refer to a person who has died at just about any period. They don't necessarily have to be in the remote past. In other words, these heroes are not necessarily connected with myth at all. There's one example, for instance, of a hero named Cleomedes, who died in 492 BC. And the historian Pausanias tells us that he was a boxer who, in anger over a judge's judgment that had gone against him, that said he lost a contest, Cleomedes went on a rampage, pulled down a school building, destroyed a school building. There happened to be 60 children in the school at the time who were all killed. Cleomedes' fellow citizens obviously were unhappy about this. They pursued him, and he miraculously disappeared. His fellow citizens were told by an oracle that he had become a hero, and they should offer sacrifices and worship to him. Now, clearly, that indicates that a hero does not have to be a good man. He has to be extraordinary in some sense. There's some aspect of his story that is unusual, but he can be unusual for performing an extraordinarily bad deed, as well as for performing an extraordinarily good one. The second main meaning of hero, apart from someone who is offered sacrifices after death, is someone who lived in the remote past, particularly someone who lived up to and into the time of the Trojan War. And this is the sense that's most important for us, because the heroes of myth are almost, without exception, the people who took part in the stories gathering around the Trojan War and the generations before the Trojan War. So when a Greek author referred to a hero, he could mean someone who lived in that past time, up to the time of the Trojan War. A third meaning, hero, could be used to refer to a human who had one divine parent, as we've seen in several stories already. Achilles, Heracles, Perseus are all heroes in that sense. A fourth sense, hero meaning the main character of a tragedy or other literary work, is post-classical, and we don't really have to worry about it here. Classical writers did not refer to the main character of a tragedy or another literary work as its hero. So, we've got the three basic senses: a dead person who is worshipped after death, someone who lived in the past up to the time of the Trojan War, someone with one divine parent. There's a great deal of overlap between those senses. Hesiod, you'll remember, refers to the race of heroes as both demigods, i.e., people with one divine parent, and men who fought around Thebes and Troy. So he's combining those two senses in saying that the people who fought the Trojan War and who fought in the great expedition of seven against Thebes were also men with one divine parent. These same legendary heroes, these same heroes who fought at Thebes and Troy, were very frequently claimed as ancestors by families who lived in the classical period of Greek culture. They were very frequently claimed as ancestors and very frequently revered as founders of cities. So there you see a combination with the idea of hero as a dead person who receives sacrifice after death. It could very well be that you would offer sacrifices to someone who had died back at the time of the Trojan War and who was therefore a hero in that sense as well. It's worth remembering, however, that the three senses are not always always present in the same hero. In particular, many of the most famous heroes of Greek mythology, such as Oedipus and Agamemnon, or for that matter Odysseus, do not have one divine parent, but have only two human parents. So hero is a rather malleable term. We will mainly use it in the rest of this course to refer to the men who took part, and women who took part, in the stories of Greek mythology, i.e. hero in the second sense I outlined, people who lived up to the time of the Trojan War. Now, the stories of those heroes, the stories of the heroes of the remote past, often involve the sense that we've talked about before, that myth so frequently reflects, that things were different in the past, that there was a time when the world operated in a different way than it now operates. We are so accustomed to classical mythology that we may not see how unusual it is to have so strong an emphasis on heroes as classical myth has. But actually, that is an unusual aspect of classical myth. We see that both in the free interaction of humans and gods — that's the way in which classical myth reflects the idea that things were different in the past — and we also see the unusual emphasis on heroes when we compare classical mythology with the mythology of other cultures. Many, many other cultures do not have nearly so many heroes in their mythology as classical myth does. For instance, Mesopotamian myth, which we've used before as a comparison to classical myth, contains almost no stories of heroes. Mesopotamian myth, by and large, is about the gods. Gilgamesh is a notable exception to that. There's a very famous Mesopotamian myth about the hero Gilgamesh. But for the most part, Mesopotamian myth does not focus on humans. Rather, it focuses on gods. The heroes of classical mythology, however, play an absolutely crucial role in classical mythology. Most, I think it's safe to say, of the stories about classical myth are stories that involve heroes in one way or another. So why is this? Why does classical mythology lay such an emphasis on heroes when that's not necessarily an element of mythology at all? Well, there are several possible ways to answer that question, of course, as is so often the case. It's possible that because Greek culture, as we've seen, laid so much emphasis on the dichotomy mortal-immortal, saw that as the primary defining characteristic of humans, that we must die, it's possible that the heroes were a means of mediating that opposition, a means of bridging that gap. Men who had one divine parent could be seen of as, in some sense, partaking of the state of being that the gods enjoy. Also, the interaction between gods and humans at the time of the heroes could be seen as, in some sense, mediating that difference, making a transition between gods and humans. And by the way, It's worth noting that the idea that gods and humans could interact with one another and could interbreed with one another is very much restricted to the remote past. I don't think any young Athenian girl, say, in 430 BC, who found herself pregnant out of wedlock, would have gotten very far if she tried to tell her father that Zeus had fathered her child. Everyone knew that Zeus did that kind of thing in the remote past. Everyone also knew that he didn't do it anymore. Another possibility that I find absolutely fascinating to account for the heroes of Greek mythology is that they preserve a kernel of historical memory in their stories. Remember in the last lecture, I talked about those two great prehistoric cultures that flourished in Greece before the development of what we call classical civilization, the Minoans and the Mycenaeans. Let's think for a moment about Mycenaean culture and how it might be reflected in the stories of the heroes and the idea of a lost golden age. As I mentioned in the previous lecture, Mycenaean culture waned after about 1100 BC. But when we say a culture waned, we don't mean that it just suddenly disappeared. The Mycenaeans did not just all pack up and leave Greece and go somewhere else. We mean that for reasons that historians still are unsure about in the case of Mycenaean culture, the culture went into a period of decline in which many of their skills were lost very, very rapidly. They lost the ability to build their magnificent buildings, which were excavated in the 19th and 20th centuries. They lost the ability to make their extraordinarily beautiful and intricate jewelry and so forth. But their descendants would have continued to live probably in and around the same sites that had been occupied by Mycenaean culture at its high point. And these descendants would have been therefore living within view of the architectural ruins from the earlier state of the culture. They probably would even have been using, for at least a couple of generations, the implements that the Mycenaeans had made at their high point. Jewelry, pottery, other artifacts would probably be handed down and continue to be used. So the Mycenaeans' descendants would have been confronted on a daily basis with the fact that they were living in and around cities and using artifacts that they could no longer themselves create, that showed a level of skill, a level of cultural development far beyond what they themselves had. Also, oral tradition would have, and we know that from the Homeric poems, that oral tradition did preserve memories of Mycenaean culture, some traces of Mycenaean culture. The Homeric epics have several references in them that refer directly to Mycenaean culture, not just the names of cities, but also of artifacts. For instance, there's a particular kind of helmet described in Homer, a boar's tooth helmet, a helmet that is covered with the teeth of boars, that corresponds perfectly to actual helmets that excavations have found in Mycenaean cities. So oral tradition preserves the memory of the people who built these cities. Their descendants live, therefore, surrounded by artifacts that they can no longer create, and with an oral tradition telling them who created these artifacts and telling them that those people were their ancestors. So by the time you get to the 8th century BC, when Hesiod writes down Theogony with the myth of the heroes in it, I think it's quite possible that what we have there is folk memory of a greater culture that actually, in fact, did precede classical Greek culture and that actually, in fact, was the ancestor of classical Greek culture. So, in this lecture, we've begun our examination of heroes and their role in Greek myth by looking at Hesiod and Ovid's stories of how the human beings came into existence and by suggesting some possible interpretations of heroes. In the next lecture, we'll focus on one particular hero, Theseus, the legendary hero of Athens.